Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
We're sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service at this time.
Hello and welcome to the World Cricket Show, the world's favourite cricket show, still plugging away in lockdown despite overwhelming popular demand. My name is Adam Bayfield, and joining me once again, the man giving me an enthusiastic thumbs up over the video chat, it's Tony Kerr.
Hey, you alright?
How's it going, Tony?
Yeah, good, thanks. As you say, plugging on, nothing too exuberant at the moment.
Well, I don't know. I am feeling quite exuberant. I'm enthusiastic, Tony. It's 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning. It's a beautiful day out there. Great day for podcasting, you might say. So, I'm raring to go. I've already been out for a walk this morning. Went to the park with my son. Came back, had a cup of tea and some crumpets. And now I'm ready to podcast.
Yeah, you've done well.
You seem slightly tired this morning. A bit sleepy.
When I suggested doing the pod at... pod at 10 on a Sunday morning. It seemed a great idea at the time. I'm a little bit jaded from yesterday, but not too bad.
I've been up for like 4 or 5 hours, Tone. I'm all kind of got a spring in my step. You know, I'm well into the day now, whereas it does appear as though you might have just rolled out of bed to do this.
Yeah, slightly. I'm in good spirits though. Obviously, in Guernsey, where we are, the lockdown restrictions have been eased slightly, haven't they, over the last couple of weeks. Particularly, there was a cause for celebration this weekend with the news that takeaways would be allowed to reopen. So I had to toast that last night. No, I didn't have a takeaway, but just toasted the idea of being able to get one.
Right.
So, yeah. No, all good, though.
Well, actually, I saw you last night. We were on a Zoom chat every Saturday night. We've been doing a quiz. Actually, want to talk more about that later in the show, about when you hosted the quiz. Although last night's one, it was a really, really good quiz that our friend Nick put together. And then at the end, like the second he finished giving the answers, we were sort of totting up our scores. And you and Emily, your girlfriend, were like, right, guys, we've got to go. I'm afraid we've got to go. I'll text you our score, Nick, but we've got to go. Got to go. Absolutely got to go. And we're like, wait, that was really abrupt. Why did they leave so quickly? And then it became apparent it was because you'd come dead last.
Yeah. There was about 10 questions about the band Dream Theater, which very much not my specialist subject.
All right. Well, we should probably talk about some cricket. We have got lots to talk about because there's actually been some cricket news that we should discuss. A little bit of movement in the cricketing world this week. I don't think they're calling it Project Restart like they are in the Premier League, but that type of thing. England players returning to training, plans to go ahead with the West Indies series in July. So we'll talk about that later on. And we've got some correspondence from listeners to dig into as well. But first, we're going to do a movie review. This is like a sort of crossover episode, isn't it? It's a bit like when Family Guy met The Simpsons. It's the World Cricket Show meets the Little Film Podcast. Because we're going to review the sports documentary that the whole world is talking about at the moment, Fire in Babylon, a movie that came out 10 years ago. It's the documentary by Stephen Riley charting the rise and dominance of that great West Indies team under Clive Lloyd in the late 70s and 80s. Now, yeah, obviously we joke about that. You know, it did come out 10 years ago, so it's not necessarily... maybe not quite as topical as, say, The Last Dance. But we wanted to talk about this now for a couple of reasons. One, because Tony's never seen it, and that feels like a bit of an omission.
Well, I have seen it now.
And two, because we've been talking on the last few episodes of the show about the great Australian team under Steve Waugh and Ricky Ponting. You know, we talked about the 2005 Ashes. We talked about that 2001 series in India. And, you know, a lot of people would say that that's the greatest team of all time. We might have even said that. The team that would probably raise the biggest objection to that, the other sort of obvious candidate for greatest team of all time is that West Indies side of the 1980s. So yeah, the film, it's really just sort of chronicling the rise of that team, the transformation of the West Indies from, you know, what were sort of always described as calypso cricketers, you know, very entertaining but not necessarily very successful. So the transformation from that to become the best team in the world, to become this kind of ruthlessly dominant machine. It starts with their capitulation in Australia in 1975-76, where they get completely taken apart by Dennis Lilly and Jeff Thompson, and how that experience convinced Clive Lloyd of the need to cultivate fast bowlers of their own. And it's just kind of interviews with the players. It's interviews with people like Gordon Greenidge and Michael Holding and Viv Richards and Colin Croft and lots more. Yeah, and they remember the team's victory in England in the long hot summer of 1976, which of course is famous for that grovel comment by England captain Tony Greig, and then World Series cricket, and then their dominance of the world after that. And the film ends with the Blackwash series in England in 1984. And as Michael Holding points out at the very end of the film, between 1980 and 1995, the West Indies did not lose a single Test series, not one. And so, this film is sort of charting the rise of that team. So, Tone, I mentioned that you'd never seen this before, but as you were keen to point out, you have seen it now. You watched it the other night. Well, you seem to be increasingly keen to sort of prove that you've done the homework.
Yeah,
for this show. Never that keen to do in the past, perhaps because you hadn't.
I enjoyed it. It's a very, very good summary of that team and summary of that era, isn't it? Very well put together. Obviously, like, you know, the inputs from the great players, they're all sort of two-man legends, aren't they? So, there's a lot of breathing room to hear from all those guys, which is great. My only thing was I would have liked to see more of the action. I don't know. It's not a very long film, is it? It's about 80 minutes. And whether that's just a rights thing, maybe they didn't have the budget to pay for, you know, more clips or whatever. And maybe it's slightly, you know, kind of spoiled in a way by the Test recently, just in terms of, like, you know, you could have seen more, you know, if there was more footage available, or even just, you know, more remembrance of certain matches or certain kind of performances or whatever. But otherwise, yeah, it's brilliant. And it's like, you know, cool to hear from some of the, you know, other kind of cricket or big cricket fans or whatever in the West Indies. You know, there's one of the whalers in there, there's some groundsmen and stuff, which it's really cool. You get a good flavor of things.
Yeah, I know what you mean. There's not necessarily quite as much footage as you might expect, but then I wonder if part of it is just that there's not, I mean, obviously the footage does exist, but the footage isn't always that great. You know, the coverage of cricket in the 1970s and 1980s was just, you know, was nothing like it is now. Even down to, you know, there was only effectively one camera there, or, you know, they didn't have a camera at each end. So you see a lot of the action sort of from behind the wicketkeeper and slips. And I sometimes wonder if that, you know, if that actually does contribute to the kind of recency bias thing that we've talked about a lot on the show. You know, when people are talking about, well, what's the greatest Test innings of all time, it seems to be between Ben Stokes, Kusal Pereira, and a couple of others that happened in the last 15 or 20 years. And people aren't thinking about Gordon Greenidge in 1984 or Viv Richards innings, or you know, obviously going further back than that into the 50s and 60s. I mean, you know, obviously the further back you go, there wasn't television at all. But even when there was in the 70s and 80s, just the footage that exists of those innings, just if it exists at all, just isn't as good. Mm. It's actually harder to see what's happening than it is with the recent stuff. And that, I mean, and that applies to me as much as anybody. You know, I don't immediately think, or certainly before watching or rewatching this film as I've done in the last week, I wouldn't immediately think of Viv Richards in the same breath necessarily as, say, Lara and Tendulkar, partly because, you know, it was before my time, but also because I haven't even really seen that much of him bat in the way that young, you know, the kids now who didn't grow up with Lawrence and Oakle will be able to watch hours and hours and hours of their greatest inning.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. And, you know, I spoke to a couple of, certainly my girlfriend's dad, who is a big cricket fan and, you know, grew up kind of watching those guys. And, you know, I said, he hadn't seen the film. I said, you know, you should definitely watch it. And we sort of talked a bit about some of the names. And he basically said, like, oh, you know, sort of gets shivers just thinking about some of those guys and, you know, yeah, Greenwich and Viv Richards and stuff. And just the impact they had. And I think for a certain generation, definitely, obviously, you know, a couple of generations before us, they'll never be topped. But yeah, having mentioned the test and before, one thing that was quite nice, having, you know, sort of slightly warmed to the Australians during the test, the series on Amazon Prime, actually sort of watching this, it was, you know, a good antidote to that, just to sort of, you know, stoke up a bit of dislike for the Australians. Because obviously, yeah, so they, you know, they talk a bit about the West Indians going to Australia and just sort of the abhorrent racism that they kind of encountered or, you know, were met with by supporters. And, you know, and I guess, you know, just the players that the Australian players then, Lily Thompson and stuff, who were sort of roughing them up and whatnot. It was, as I say, a good, good balance to the test.
Actually, what you're saying there, that's one of the reasons why I was going to say that. I actually found this film very moving. As I say, I have seen it before. I saw it when it came out, and I probably did find it moving at the time, but I didn't remember it being quite as emotional as I found it this time. And it's for a few reasons, and one of them is what you're talking about there. I mean, it was genuinely upsetting to hear Gordon Greenidge talking about the racist abuse that he suffered in Australia in 1975. He says something like, "It degraded me," you know, and a few of them talk about that. That feeds into the fact that another reason I found it moving is because you see how significant this team was for West Indian people at that time. The kind of the joy and the meaning that cricket brought them at that time, and this team as a symbol of the big transformations that were going on in the region and around the world. You know, it's not that long after, you know, after Martin Luther King, the civil rights movement, the end of empire, migration into Britain, all that kind of stuff, and the way that perceptions were very slowly being changed in the white world, and actually how the success of this team helped to accelerate those changes. You know, that they did suffer that appalling racist abuse in 1975, 1976. I'm not saying that after they, you know, that after they started winning a few series that suddenly there wasn't any more racist abuse. Clearly, that's not true. It still happens today. But you see them talking about how proud they were to be able to basically prove a point to those people that were giving them that abuse. And it's easy to forget, you know, what a different time it was. I mean, 1976 is only 16 years after Frank Worrell became the first black captain of the West Indies. Before 1960, it had to be a white man. I mean, that's kind of crazy to think about now, but it's actually not that long ago.
Yeah, and only 10 years before we were born. It's not ancient history either, is it? It's I didn't really appreciate, I have to say, until watching this, quite how significant that side of the story was. It wasn't, I don't know, I was trying to think. I mean, when you look at what they achieved, completely separate to all of that, but actually, like, I don't know, would there ever have been a sports team as driven by injustice, kind of in that sense, in quite the same way? I don't know, I can't think of many. You know, when you hear these guys speak, the kind of the journey from, as you say, like Greenwich talking about that, like Michael Holding basically kind of being in tears as a young man on the pitch, kind of in the face of this kind of stuff. And I guess you're kind of, you know, as cricket fans now, you know, growing up when we did, you're sort of used to hearing Michael Holding as a commentator and being a sort of, you know, a voice of authority and you know, speaking for people in the game. But you kind of forget that he was obviously a very young man when this was all happening. It's an amazingly horrible thing for someone to have to go through.
I was going to say, he was a teenager on that Australia tour, I think, wasn't he?
Yeah. But yeah, that journey from kind of facing up to all of that and basically saying, rather than, you know, being kind of defeated by it, to say, actually, you know, screw you, we're going to be the best, yeah, the best there is, and you're going to have to deal with it. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, as I say, I did find it really upsetting to hear Greenwich and Holding talking about those experiences, and it made me really angry. And it's, as you say, the fact that they were, it's one of the things that made them so driven. And it's really satisfying as a viewer to then see them go on and dominate in the way that they did. And as you say, the other side of the story is, you know, is just what an amazing cricket team they became. And, you know, I've thought this before, but watching this documentary again, one of my main thoughts coming away from it was just, my God, I wish I'd seen them live.
Yeah.
As you say, like you speaking to your girlfriend's dad, I mean, my older brothers, you know, I've grown up hearing my older brothers talk about them, but they were before our time, really. I mean, we've sort of talked about the post-Atherton era as starting in around, you know, the post-Atherton era being the period of cricket that we've watched, like, you know, from our sort of earliest memories of watching cricket starting in around 1994. And, you know, that the sort of the changing of the guard, you know, the end of the dynasty was in 1995 when Australia beat West Indies. So it really pretty much exactly coincided. Our time of watching cricket pretty much exactly coincided with the end of that West Indian team. So we didn't see them. And it's, you know, from a personal point of view, that's really tragic, because yeah, this film does just bring home what a hell of a team they were. Like, just, I mean, especially those fast bowlers. I mean, it's terrifying to watch, isn't it?
Which of them would you have least liked to face, do you think?
That's a really tough question. I would have always said either Holding or Garner. Possibly Garner, just because of the height.
Yeah, I thought you'd say Garner. I mean, we don't hear so much from him, do we, in the documentary
no.
as the others. But yeah, just.
But I was gonna say actually, after watching this, possibly Andy Roberts.
I've written some notes, and I wrote that my first note is, how scary is Viv? Just the way he talks.
Yeah.
And then the second one is, Andy Roberts, scary.
Yeah. I was gonna say Andy Roberts is maybe MVP of the film.
There's a
great line from him that they talk about how, you know, how batsmen around the world were really scared of him, and that he used to hurt people. And then he's just like, he's such a cool guy, and he's so kind of like, giving these interviews, he's just like so laid back, kind of chilling out in his chair in his house. And he's just like, they're talking about this, and then it just cuts to him, and he's like, I didn't go out to try to hit people. It's just that a lot of people got hit.
Yeah, I jotted that down as well. It's genius. It reminded me, having watched The Irishman, not that long ago, it kind of made me think of that. He was sort of like the sort of Joe Pesci. It's like the kind of aging kind of gangster who sort of talks. He's like so softly spoken now, but it's obviously done a lot of damage in his time.
I mean, I think Michael Holding is maybe the best to watch, just because of that action, that kind of liquid action. It's, you know, must be one of the most sort of aesthetically pleasing bowling actions in history. But yeah, possibly Andy Roberts would be the one I'd least like to face. We don't see a huge amount of Malcolm Marshall, but a lot of people would consider him to be the best. A lot of people would consider him to be the best fast bowler of all time. But he comes in slightly later, and he comes in around that 83-84 time, more in the Viv Richards era than the Viv Richards as captain era than the Clive Lloyd era. But yeah, I mean, just what a terrifying prospect, because it was the depth of it as well. You know, the number of great fast bowlers that they had, the guys who couldn't even get in the team, is crazy.
The sequel, the bit where, you know, and you do see a few of the deliveries to Brian Close in 1976, and it's actually astonishing to watch. And I don't know, he was about 45 then, wasn't he, Brian Close?
He was, yeah.
It's just absolutely staggering. It's like watching someone's dad go out to face like the most brutal attack in history.
It's like, how did anyone allow this?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, how is this legal that someone could go out to face that without a helmet? Like, you know, the idea that helmets were like this kind of, you know, newfangled innovation. It's like, well, obviously you need a helmet if you're going to face that. It's mental. That was one of my stray observations that I jotted down was, you know, I almost burst out laughing at one point, just like thinking about how much cricket has changed. Like, you know, the difference between, I don't know, one of these sort of, you know, watching, I don't know, Johnny Bairstow or some kind of like young, you know, live young man go out in IPL, you know, in a T20 or something like that, versus Brian Close, 45 years old, wandering out without a helmet.
In a jumper.
He just looks like an old man.
Barely a hair on the top of his head. I mean, it's like extraordinary, extraordinarily brave thing to do. And like, oh, yeah, it's certainly just the thought of it just sent shivers down my spine. And, you know, you see the damage that's done to him. He's got like, he finishes the day, I think, with about 10 bull-shaped bruises on his rib cage. It's like horrifying. You just think like, what, I don't know, could they have not found anyone else? Like someone maybe who had like, he could have ducked and weaved a bit, whereas he just sort of stood there and wore it, which is, yeah, absolutely incredible.
So incredibly brave. But yeah, I did just think like, who allowed this? But so, I mean, yeah, the fast bowlers are obviously the thing that really leaps out from that team. And it's the most famous thing about that team. But as you'll remember from when we interviewed Gordon Greenidge and Desmond Haynes in Barbados last year, they were very keen to point out, perhaps for understandable reasons, sometimes people forget about how good the batting lineup was as well, you know, with those two being at the heart of it, but also Viv Richards. I mean, Greenidge, Haynes, Richards must be one of the best top threes of all time. But then people like Collis King and Alvin Kalacharan, Lawrence Rowe, Larry Gomes as well. I mean, just 1 to 11, it's a hell of a team. We're going to do a more kind of thorough, more detailed comparison of them and that Australian team next time. Perhaps even a composite 11 might be drawn up.
Big.
It's a very tough call, isn't it? It's a very close run thing. But what I would say, we'll ultimately, you know, we will be the ultimate arbiters of which team was better. We'll give the definitive verdict next time. But all I was going to say here is just that in terms of sparking joy, I think it's a bit of a no-brainer. Like, I think there's surely never been a better team than this one in that regard.
Yeah, I think you're probably. Yeah, I think you're probably right. One thing, we'll talk about it with next time, I guess. One thing that I've been, got me thinking after that. You know, we often talk about, people in cricket talk about compare the teams and players that have come since to this kind of era of West Indian cricket, and it is, you know, after watching this and thinking about it a bit more, it's kind of, you think it's a bit more unfair, perhaps, because given the sort of politics of West Indian cricket and the diversity of the islands and everything, like it's almost unlikely in any way that in some ways compared to other cricketing nations. Like in the first instance, that's obviously a barrier to getting a good team together. But clearly this was like a team of exceptional players at a time, I guess, when cricket was, in terms of participation, it was probably an exceptional time as well. Yeah, in the West Indies, and then. You talk about this kind of exceptional fire that was sort of inside them to go on and do what they did. It's almost, you sort of, it's a situation that could almost not be recreated, probably.
It's a unique moment.
Yeah, so it is probably pretty harsh to compare. But then actually on the flip side, like the West Indies is still producing game-changing players in the same way. You know, Gale, obviously Andre Russell, Pollard, Narayan, players who will be remembered as kind of landmark players in the kind of development of T20, and obviously it's a great shame that the same focus isn't there for West Indian Test cricket still. But the flip side being that perhaps things aren't quite as bad as some people make out as well. So I don't know.
I think that's right, and that also it's unfair to compare them to that team because, as you say, that team was unique. You know, that was probably more the exception. Yeah, it was a golden generation. But as you say, there's still plenty of talent there. There's no question about the talent. You know, there's questions over the administration and just globally around the way cricket is going and the economics of cricket, which mean that, for those players, it makes a lot more sense for their careers and their financial future to focus on T20 than Test cricket. But, and also things like the pitches in the Caribbean, just aren't the same as they were in the 70s and 80s. They're not as conducive to producing fast bowlers as they were then. So there's lots of reasons for it. But yeah, it's always been a bit unfair, I think. In the same way that it's unfair to compare any Australian spinner to Shane Warne, even Nathan Lyon, who's very good. is not Shane Warne, but it's like, well, obviously, you know, it's like Mozart. Or, you know, I don't know why he's the first name that popped into my head. But you know what I mean? It's, you know, you're run of the mill classical composer. It's just not gonna stand up to Mozart. It's a bit unfair to be like, nah, not as good as Viv Richards. And speaking of Viv Richards, like that's another, you know, another thing about this film that it really does kind of, you know, there's a real sort of lionization of Viv Richards, and there's an amazing song sung by a man in an extraordinary turquoise suit about Viv Richards, and singing a song with lines like "he's remarkable at batting" or something like that.
Yeah,
it was great. I loved it. But yeah, I mean, you've got to say truly one of the very best batsmen of all time. As I talked about with, you know, perhaps the lack of footage and stuff, like I would always say that Brian Lara is the best batsman I've ever seen. I would put him ahead of Sachin and Ponting and Smith and, you know, and anyone else. But obviously, I didn't see Viv Richards live. And most people who did, you know, most people who saw both Viv and Lara would say that Viv was better than Lara. You know, Viv is still, I think, celebrated in the Caribbean, perhaps even more than Lara. And that might be part of that joy thing again. You know, he perhaps brought people more joy than Lara did. You know, and it could be to do with the fact that he was part of that team that, as we say, was sort of, making a statement around the world. That was just the thing that really stood out to me was how good Viv Richards was watching this. Just a couple more stray observations before we move on. Did you notice Jason Holder at the start?
No.
You know, the opening shot of the film.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, okay, cool.
It's like a teenager running into bowl on a beach or in a field on one of the Caribbean islands. And it's Jason Holder. Yeah, I think it's 17-year-old Jason Holder. And the other thing I was going to say is, I just wrote down, Clive Lloyd, what a legend.
Yeah. Definitely.
And what a look as well.
Yeah, just a genius. Like such a cool, kind of calm presence. But yeah, as you say, just an exceptional look. You just couldn't get away with that today, I don't think. It's kind of like, there's a sort of like granddad chic to it, isn't there? It's like, he sort of definitely looked old before his time.
Maybe not for people who saw it at the time, but perhaps for the likes of us, for our generation, perhaps an underappreciated part of that success. Because, you know, you do think of Viv and you think of the fast bowlers, but I think they would say that Clive Lloyd was, you know, so integral to that team with the bat as well. He ended his career with a test average of 46.7, scored 1900s. Yeah, an excellent player as well as an excellent captain. So that's Fire in Babylon, Tone. I really enjoyed rewatching this. I'm glad you did too.
Definitely,
as I kind of alluded to at the beginning of this segment, there's so many sports documentaries around at the moment. We've obviously talked about the test. Have you been watching this Michael Jordan documentary?
Yeah, I've watched the first few episodes.
I've really been surprised by how much I've enjoyed it, because I couldn't care less, or at least I, before watching this, I couldn't care less about basketball, but it's brilliant.
Yeah, it is. It's fantastically well done, isn't it? And again, like, I definitely didn't really appreciate Michael Jordan.
No.
At the time or since, or basketball really in general. And yeah, I agree. Like, you know, obviously it's not something we really played at school. It's not something that necessarily, you know, it's kind of dwarfed by other sports, obviously in the UK, even though it is, you know, very popular. But I never really appreciated basketball as a sport until, you know, listeners may not know, there's a thing called the Island Games, which, you know, the Channel Islands and other islands around the world really go and compete at. It's a multi-sport thing. But basketball is one of the sports there. And I watched a bit for the first time. It's probably the first kind of live basketball I've really ever watched, I think, kind of up close. And it's obviously not at the same level as the Bulls of the 90s. But it's a really good standard, and it's a fantastic sport. Actually, it was fantastically exciting, and I just so physical. I didn't really appreciate how physically kind of charged it is. So yeah, that's definitely kind of made me see the sport in a slightly different light. But it's an awesome documentary. Some fantastic characters in there as well.
I agree. It's you know, as I say, I couldn't care less about it, but I've always thought it was quite a good game, and like of the American sports, I've always thought it was by far the best game to watch, but sort of perhaps underestimated how exciting it could be. And as you say, I just, you know, Michael Jordan just passed me by. It's been interesting watching this with my girlfriend, who's French, because I kind of slightly scoffed a couple of times when people said, oh, well, you know, he's the most famous athlete on the planet, you know, like in the mid-90s, where he's the most famous athlete on the planet. And I was like, yeah, right, come on. But she was saying, well, yeah, he was. Like in France, yeah, that was the case, which is interesting. So like for us in England at the time, or they, yeah, I think there was another bit where they said, well, the Chicago Bulls are the most famous, the most supported sports team on the planet. And I was like, that is absolutely ridiculous. And she was like, well, who else? And I said, well, Manchester United at the time, definitely. And she was just like, no, I don't think so. Like, not in France at the time. It was, you know, it was the Bulls and Michael Jordan was all anyone was talking about. So that was interesting.
Yeah, that struck me as well. And the other thing, and it is just like, it kind of highlights the difference in just the sports culture in America, in that like they talk, all the people that speak in the documentary, you know, they're kind of glowing and like so excited by the idea of a dynasty. It's like the Holy Grail, like, you know, what a privilege to be watching a team kind of dominate all that. And obviously we've just been talking about, you know, the West Indians dominating cricket, but certainly from my perspective, like there's only so much kind of domination you can take before you sort of start to just absolutely hate a team. And that you kind of, the idea of it, that a team, you sort of celebrate a team dominating kind of stuff, even though we've just kind of done that. I think the West Indian cricketers is definitely an exception in that I think the neutral can enjoy that more than, say, you know, if it was Man United dominating football in England, you know, most other fans, while you'd appreciate their ability in retrospect, like you don't really sort of treasure the dynastic kind of domination.
Definitely not. Well, I have always hated and continue to hate Man United because they were so dominant when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think the West Indies are an exception because of what we've been talking about, the sort of social and cultural reasons why that team was so significant, you know, and the joyfulness with which they played the game and that they created and that they sort of sparked in the people watching. But yeah, I agree. Teams that dominate are annoying. Like, I still think, just going back to that thing of, you know, them saying, well, the Bulls are the, you know, the most popular sports team on the planet. Like, there's still, you said this, like, there's definitely an insularity about American sport, which does rub me up the wrong way a bit in terms of, you know, when he retired, or, you know, first retired in 1993, the owner of the Bulls at the press conference is saying, well, Michael Jordan, he's the greatest athlete on a team sport ever, period. And you think, well, and there's a lot of, well, that is the greatest in the world, the best this in the world, the best that in the world. And you think, well, that would be a bit like us saying Shane Warne is the best athlete in any team sport ever. It's like, I suppose the word athlete in that context might be might be inappropriate anyway, but you know what I mean? It's like, well, you know, you might not be considering some of the other things that you've, that, you know, that exist. But anyway, it's a fantastic documentary, and I just kind of want I want that, but for, you know, cricket teams that I love, or a football team, you know, I want that, but for Wimbledon in Wimbledon FC in the 90s. If Netflix are listening,
There's a bit, isn't it, in that Fyre Festival documentary? Who's the, I can't remember what the guy's called. It was a quiz question actually a few weeks ago, wasn't it?
It was a quiz question that I got wrong, so I don't know.
Bill McFarland or something. Bucky McFarland, or something, I don't know. but it, I think in that film, doesn't he say, like, he's like, oh, it doesn't really matter what happens, just film everything, you know? But that should really be the mantra for life, because even in, like, 30 years, someone could just, you know, stitch that footage together and tell an amazing story. So, yeah, maybe we should just be filming more.
That's why I've asked a camera crew to film, film backstage of the podcast for the last 10 years.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss.
That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
All right, Tane. Well, moving on. Actually, just before we talk about that news I mentioned in the cricketing world, just to catch up on a couple of bits of correspondence from listeners. People may have heard on our previous episode, amongst other things, we did a kind of full nostalgia and did some reminiscing about a cricket tour of our own to the Isle of Wight, Guernsey under 14s going to the Isle of Wight in 2001, a tour which has lived in infamy for all those involved ever since. Quite a few people got in touch about that, including this email that's come in from a listener by the name of Rob, who says, "Hi, Tony and Adam. I don't know why he's put Tony and Adam. I'm not sure I'm happy about that. Hi, Tony and Adam. Hang on, I'll correct it. Hi, Adam and Tony. Long-time listener, sometime tweeter, and first-time emailer here. I'm a huge fan of the show and rarely miss an episode, and I thought I'd get in touch to tell you about a dream I had the night after listening to your most recent episode. I should say that the subject line of this email is next man in, Tony Kerr. I dreamt that I was out in the middle on my old school's cricket pitch, batting with Virender Sehwag. I was at the non-striker's end, and I was trying to warn the great man not to play any rash shots, as Tony Kerr was the next man in, and his clownish showboating would doubtless lead us the game. Unfortunately, Sehwag was unable to hear me, because he was singing loudly to himself as he batted. I watched on, terrified that the singing Sehwag would give his wicket away carelessly, bringing Kerr to the crease, and so ending any chance we had of victory. Thankfully, I woke up before Tony got the opportunity to disgrace the team with his antics. I can only hope Sehwag and I batted on to save the game. Clearly, the latest episode of the show had a profound effect on me. Anyway, keep up the good work. Best wishes, Rob." So there you go, Tony.
Wow. It's both hilarious and brutal in equal measure. I like to think that Rob maybe thinks of me as a sort of Kyrgios of cricket, kind of, you know, worldly talented, but just, you know, a bit of a plonker. Sadly, yeah, I'm neither that talented nor, yeah.
Well, you're not that talented, but you are a bit of a plonker.
Well, at least one side of it holds up. No, the thought of any pair of batsmen at the crease thinking that Tony Kerr's the next man in, you know, that's enough to keep you there and do it yourself.
Shivers down the spine.
Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? This is a thing that people are dreaming a lot, having really intense and weird dreams during lockdown. I'm dreaming all the time. I don't know about you. You look confused, like you're not one of these people, but it is. There was a BBC News article about it the other day.
I don't know. I've had a few dreams, but no more than...
I'm just dreaming constantly. But it made me laugh the other day when our friend James was talking about a nightmare that he had, which is something that I have, like, too often, where I dream that I'm at school and I've got an exam tomorrow or this morning and I've not revised for it, or it's a subject that I didn't even know I was taking. But you really made me laugh, Tane, saying that you have a dream like that at the moment, and then you wake up and go, "Oh, phew, it's just a pandemic."
Yeah, I did have a couple of stress dreams the other night. Actually, now you come to mention it,
there was a BBC News article about it. Apparently, it's because people aren't getting enough stimulation during the day, so their brains are going crazy at night.
True of Rob, who had to endure the last podcast then, understimulated.
He wasn't the only one to get in touch about that. That Isle of Wight story seemed to elicit quite a big reaction from listeners. Some people sympathising. I think sympathising, not necessarily empathising. I think for a lot of people, it's perhaps hard to imagine being
pitying.
That bad at cricket. Yeah, pitying, exactly. I was thinking about this. I don't think we ever won a game. Can you remember ever winning a game?
I don't remember a game we won.
I that's not an exaggeration. I genuinely don't think we ever won a game. It was like, that was just... what you expected to happen. Oh, who are we losing to today?
Well, we probably talked about this, but yeah, latterly we played together, didn't we, for the school second 11 team. That was kind of a few years after the debacle of the Isle of Wight. and we kind of dusted ourselves off a bit. But yeah, we had to sort of drop down to second 11 level to get a game at that point. But yeah, we actually beat our equivalent school in Jersey both years, and I was captain, which was a remarkable, you know, given the last review from Rob there about his interpretation of my cricket. You know, I'd love to have known the discussion or the thought process behind making me captain.
Well, I think the rest of us all had that conversation at the time.
But we actually won both those games, and it was actually I do remember thinking like I'm like being on top in a match and actually not knowing really what to do.
Yeah, we also had a tweet come in from a listener by the name of Julian after that show went out saying, "Wonderful podcast, guys. Really laughed at your Isle of Wight reminiscences. Perhaps by way of balance on the next pod, you could talk about your finest moments on the cricket field," which is a good idea, Tane. So I think starting now, let's go through all the good moments we had on the cricket field. All right, Tane. Well, I mentioned at the top of the show that we had some actual cricket news to discuss today. It was announced this week that England players are returning to training ahead of a planned restart of international action, with the Test series against West Indies being delayed, but now expected to go ahead in July. I'm just going to quickly run through this article from Crick Info, just to put us all on the same page. England set to resume training as ECB lay groundwork for Windies tests. England's men's players will move one step closer to return to international cricket next week when they resume training in controlled environments at a range of venues across the country. The announcement comes in the wake of official government advice published on Wednesday, which set out the safety protocols and social distancing measures necessary to safeguard the players and staff during the COVID-19 outbreak. And with a possible 7 weeks to go until the delayed first test against West Indies is earmarked to get underway behind closed doors, a squad of 30 players with a Red Bull focus at this stage will begin to assemble at 7 venues across the country from Wednesday onwards to resume individual skills-based training programs. The move is intended to mitigate the potential for injury for England's players, who have not set foot on a cricket field since the abandonment of the Sri Lanka tour midway through their first warm-up match in Colombo on March 12. The players' initial focus will be on individual field-based skills, with full net sessions deferred for a further 2 weeks until the bowlers have reached their desired workload after having their fitness regimes interrupted by 2 months in lockdown. So yeah, it goes on from there, Tone. But yeah, basically that's the gist of it. They are going back to training, and the plan is to get that Test series going ahead in July. I thought I'd throw this to you as a qualified epidemiologist. You know, seems the right place to go. But no, just you know, what do you think, Tane? Do you see this happening? Do you think this is a good idea?
I don't know, to be honest.
I joke about that, about being a qualified epidemiologist, but we, you know, I suppose we do have to caveat it with just saying, you know, we don't know what we're talking about.
We don't.
Yeah. Then you do just have to leave it to the people who do know what they're talking about. But with that being said, what do you think?
I mean, with the whole sport thing in general, I do sympathize with both kind of extremes of the argument. Like, you know, I understand why people think it's sort of, it should just be forgotten about for now. But I also understand the people who are like, oh, yeah, sport has to come back as soon as possible. You know, it's clearly a lot of people's jobs depend on it. The idea that it's kind of, you know, it'll improve the national psyche, I think, is maybe like slightly spurious, although it certainly would for some people. But
why do you think that's spurious?
No, I partly because I think it won't be the product that people perhaps think it will be. You know, look at the Bundesliga that came back this weekend with no one in the stadium. I mean, I've seen a few clips. I didn't actually watch any of the games, but from what I've seen, most of the feedback has been like, it's something to talk about, but not necessarily, you know, it's nowhere near, it's not going to generate the same kind of, I'm not speaking about German football fans, perhaps they might have a different opinion, but certainly, you know, the sort of British sports people I've seen, you know, talking about it have said like, oh, you know, it's a pretty poor imitation of the real thing. And, you know, has it sort of changed the opinion on whether we should rush back the Premier League? When it comes to cricket, I think it's slightly different. I don't know. I think that just the nature of the sport, the nature of crowds for the sport, like I think they could probably get them back a bit sooner.
Well, I mentioned this last time when we were talking about that India-Australia series, and you know, the fact there are 100,000 people in Kolkata in 2001 for that test, and how important that was, and you know, what an important element of great test matches and great cricketing action and great sporting action the crowds are, and it's sometimes forgotten, and that that should be a consideration. But then, I mean, I still, you know, I would still stand by that. But on the other hand, I suppose test cricket, you know, has some experience of you know, being played out in front of empty stands. Like, it's always a bit weird in the UAE, say, when, you know, when Pakistan have played England or anyone else in the UAE and there's basically no one there. It's like, it's a slightly strange atmosphere and it's not what you want, but it has happened. And, you know, and I've watched it and it's like taken some of the shine off it, but it's you know, it's still been watchable, and it's not quite the same as football in that sense, I don't think. Yeah, on the sort of national psyche point, I do take that point, but I suppose it just depends how long this goes on. You know, people will manage without football for the next few months, they'll manage without cricket this summer, but you know, if it's gonna run a lot longer than that, I think sport will leave a big hole if they can't get it on in some form.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard. I don't think you can be too sort of harsh on anyone's viewpoints in this situation, can you? Because no one's lived through a situation like this. I mean, when you look at, like, it has only still been 8-9 weeks. And while that is a long time, obviously, you know, when you compare it to the Second World War, and I know, like, not everything should be compared to that. That was obviously, you know, many times longer. It will recover, whatever, however long that it's out of action or it's you know, it's not going on. But that said, yeah, I don't know, maybe the situation is improving enough to suggest that actually that it's fine and we should crack on. I don't know.
Yeah, I'll come to that in a sec, but just one more thing on the sort of on the morale issue, like the idea that getting support back on will boost the nation's morale. Again, like, yeah, it has, as you say, it has only been 8-9 weeks, which is actually, you know, we haven't really missed that much cricket yet. We've obviously missed England series in Sri Lanka. That didn't happen. And the IPL hasn't happened. Personally, I don't really watch that. So I don't feel like I've really missed that much cricket yet, or I shouldn't feel like that. Because it has only been 8-9 weeks. Or, you know, that's not much different to like the off season in the Premier League, is it? So it's not that long a time. If it ends up being 6 months or a year or more, then I think people will start to notice it a lot more. But the other point as well is that in terms of boosting the nation's morale, like, to some extent, there have been other things that have done that. Like, you know, for us here in Guernsey, Tone, like, you know, the weather's been great and we've been allowed to go outside. And, you know, there are reasons why we might not necessarily have been watching that much sport at home on the TV anyway. But if this rolls on into next winter and we're all just kind of shut up indoors with not much to do, do you know what I mean? Like,
that's a fair point.
Then we might be like, well, I really would love to watch some football right now or some cricket. So I think it could yet come to play quite an important role, you know, in terms of morale. But that being said, as I say, you know, it is important to say that, that we are not really qualified to talk about it from a sort of, you know, scientific point of view. But with that sort of well caveated, I have to say I have my doubts about this plan, because I think there are issues for the players, you know, and how players might feel about their health and safety in going back out to play cricket at the moment. You know, obviously no one's going to force them to play, but they are going to feel under pressure to play if it's going ahead. You know, players who might sort of potentially lose their place in the England team if they choose not to play for some time. Now, of course, this is true of employees across all sorts of industries, that people perhaps might feel under pressure to go back to work, you know, in a way that they feel might compromise their health and the health of others. But, you know, still, I think that should be a consideration. And that's true not just of the England players, but of course, you know, perhaps even more importantly of the West Indies players, and maybe later in the summer, the Pakistan players. You know, is it fair to expect them to travel to England at the moment, given the relative states of the epidemics in the two countries or the two regions? So much of this is unknowable. Like, it hugely depends on what happens with the virus in England over the next weeks and months. You know, if there is a second wave now that lockdown's been eased, you know, presumably this won't happen. If it continues to go in the right direction, if the numbers continue to go in the right direction, then perhaps it can. But the big thing for me is that I think, you know, even if even if the numbers do continue to move generally in the right direction, all these plans to get cricket back on, to get football back on, to get all sport back on, you know, they all assume, they all depend on things going smoothly. You know, they're sort of, they're talking about isolating the players, social distancing, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what happens if one of the players tests positive for the virus, you know, a few days before the game? Then what? I don't know. And that doesn't seem that unlikely necessarily. So, as I say, there's just so, there's so many unknowns and unknowables and uncontrollables. I understand why, and in some ways sort of admire the fact that they're trying to get it, get the show back on the road. But, you know, just from a sort of fan's point of view, I just don't think we should necessarily get our hopes up that it is going to happen.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to, yeah, to kind of temper expectations a bit. I agree. I think what would cricket administrators be doing if they weren't planning, or any sports administrations, if they weren't planning or working out a way that they could get it on, even if it might not kind of work out that way? You know, they've got to have, they've got to be doing something. So that may as well be that. I think you're right. In essence, kind of morally, given that, you know, we're allowed to, and I know there's a different definitions of what's essential and what's not, but I don't know, in England at the moment, what you know, pub gardens are open, or outdoor restaurants are open. The environment, the cricket environment, is it any more risky than that? Probably not in terms of spreading the virus. But as you say, it's obviously a very different work environment to, you go to the supermarket and you get, you pick up the virus and you test positive and they contact trace or whatever, and you just work from home or whatever, or you self-isolate or something. That obviously, as you say, that's just not feasible for two sports teams who are going to be playing a match. It's just, yeah, it's so easily derailed, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very sort of fragile situation. You know, I do hope that it can happen, just from a, you know, kind of selfish personal point of view. It would be, I would enjoy watching cricket this summer. But yeah, I just think it's, I think there's reasons to not be too optimistic yet. All right, Tone. Well, I think that's probably as good a place as any to draw a line under things for this week. We talked about going for a run. I need to go for a run with you at some point.
Yeah. When should we do that?
Tomorrow?
Yeah, sounds
we're
good.
We're now allowed to exercise together with people from outside our household. So, to be honest, I feel like I've seen too much of you this weekend. Because,
yeah.
I'd done this and then did see you on the Zoom quiz last night. I mentioned at the top of the show, I teased at the top of the show that I wanted to talk about when it was your turn to host the quiz. When was it, last week or the week before? I can honestly say, Tone, I've never seen anything like
it. Wow.
Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I'll leave it up to you. No, it was a memorable quiz. It was definitely a memorable quiz. We started, what, 10 or 15 minutes late? You were quite happy because last night we started like half an hour late because our friend Nick was even later.
Yeah.
And you were like, oh, this is good. This is kind of takes the heat off me. But it became clear quite quickly that you needed those extra 15 minutes to finish writing the questions.
Yeah.
Which you hadn't done.
Real echoes of my school days there. Sort of doing the homework in the class kind of before it's handed in.
But then trying to sort of give off the impression that that isn't what had happened.
Exactly. Trying to play it cool.
And that's going, have you just written the question? Say, no. But you had like various, you had them all scribbled on various scraps of paper. I've never seen anyone look more flustered than you did in those first couple of rounds as you were trying to find the right bit of paper.
It was stressful.
You were so stressed that I think at one point, your girlfriend Emily, who's, you know, who had the thankless task of trying to mark the answers, you know, when you hadn't actually numbered the questions, they were just on bits of paper floating around. You had to work out which answer belonged where. But yeah, at one point she said something to you like, "Oh, what's the answer to this one?" And you said, and it made me burst out laughing, "No, I read the question, but I haven't written it down." The stress was really getting to you at that point.
Yeah, it was tough. It was very tough. I like to think it was more of a sort of just avant-garde approach to quizzing, you know. Everything, it's all got very formulaic during the lockdown. It's all a bit predictable, a bit safe. You know, let's mix it up a bit. Let's not have numbers next to the questions.
Postmodern quizzing. Don't write any questions. Just out of the blue, guy. Which country produces the most olives? Which was one of your questions.
Yeah.
It was like, I know you're not a big fan of Gavin and Stacey, but there's an episode of that where Smithy hosts a pub quiz he's just there, like, with his hand in his head in his hands, going, "Who invented the plug?"
Yeah, that's it. That literally was it.
Well, I mean, in the end, to be fair to you, it was actually quite a good quiz.
That's good.
It just got off to a bit of a rocky start.
I've pulled it around. Had I had a bit more time to plan it, you know, not a full week, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, I would have still left it at the same time. But I might have deployed the rounds in a slightly different order.
But it's definitely one of those things, wasn't it, where you wrote like 1 or 2 questions on Thursday?
Oh, yeah, exactly that.
And you were like, "I am brilliant. I am so far ahead of the game here."
Just popping champagne, just being like this, you know, smashed it.
Then you put your notebook down, tied your elastic band around it, and didn't give it another thought until 8:25 on the Saturday evening, and realised you had to write another 48 questions. Well, you pulled it out of the bag in the end, Tane.
Yeah, we got there.
Just a shame you came dead last in the quiz last night.
Who's doing the quiz next week?
Dim and Megan.
Okay, cool.
They came second last. The thing being that if you come last in the quiz, you have to do the following week's quiz. It can't be you because you've already done it. But, you know, my problem, Tane, I'd actually really like to host a quiz, but I just never going to come last, am I?
Well, might try. I'll volunteer to do it the week after next, and I'll create a quiz tailor-made that you won't be able to answer.
What would you put in that quiz?
I don't know. It'd be like, you know, cuts of beef, maybe. Craft beers, cuts of beef, and like, yeah.
If there was any practical element to it, that's where I might fall down. If part of the quiz was to like put together some flat pack furniture, then I'd start thinking about the following week's quiz already.
3 rounds of CDT.
Anyway, I think we should probably leave it there, Tane. We'll be back soon to talk more cricket, more nostalgia probably. But between now and then, if you enjoy the World Cricket Show, there are various ways you can get more involved. You can send us an email, like our good friend Rob did, worldcricketshow@gmail.com. You can follow us on social media. And if you enjoy the show, then do tell people about it by writing a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you use, because that does really help to bring new people to the show. But yeah, that's it. Stay in school. Just to say that, you know, whoever's listening to this, I hope everybody is safe and well and holding up okay in lockdown. And we will be back soon.
Right, looking forward to the next one.
All right. Cheers, mate.
Take it easy. Stay safe.
Bye for now. I can smell your fear. Ba-da-da-ba-ba, ba-da-da-ba-ba.